for reasons that will become evident, because Dr. Rebecca Priestley, who describes herself as working at the boundary between science and the humanities, is or has been for a long, long time deep in love with Antarctica. She's director of Victoria University's Centre for Science and Society. She has just combined her knowledge of earth sciences, geology and geography, with her MA in creative writing, to produce a memoir of her visits to Antarctica. It's called 15 Million Years in Antarctica, and it is the most personal of her several books. And here she is now. Hello.
Hello.
Just listening to that and imagining you stomping your way through the ice and snow in Antarctica. It's very appropriate, isn't it?
Yeah, that was my kind of go-to song when I was there. And every time I've listened to it since, it just takes me right back. Yeah.
You've been to Antarctica three times.
Mm-hmm.
2011, 2014, 2018. Yep. A repeat offender, as they say. But you had yearned to go for years.
Yeah, I think since I was an undergraduate student at Victoria University of Wellington, and I was studying geology, and there was a strong Antarctic program. And so, you know, people went to Antarctica, and it was a possibility. And I guess that's when it started for me. And I actually had this really intense dream of being there that was just one of those really powerful dreams that kind of, you know, you wake up and you think, I must follow up on this. And that's when I started applying to go.
And being rejected.
Yeah. About
or being unable.
About four times I applied, you know, through competitive processes to go to Antarctica as a research student, as PR officer for Antarctica New Zealand, back when they had someone down there for 6 months. I was only about 20. And then on various media programs.
But finally...
Finally.
In 2011, under what auspices did you go there that time? That was a...
This was on the Antarctica New Zealand invited media program.
Yep.
Yeah. So I didn't even have to apply. But I had made it very clear that if there was a, you know, if it was an option, I was very keen.
What's the most interesting science being done in Antarctica, do you think?
Oh, well, my background's in geology, and I'm very close to the scientists who are working on paleoclimatology down there, and for me that's the most interesting. That, you know, trying to elucidate the past climate of Antarctica, what it was like under different levels of CO2
in the atmosphere. Hence the 15 million years in Antarctica title.
Yeah.
As you say, your interest is in geology and geography. I'm very interested in snippets of your life that you reveal in this book. And you talk about how your mother, when she was between marriages, dated one of the leading geologists of the time that I don't know whether he taught you when you were at university.
Yeah, he was there, Peter Barrett. He so I met him when I was a child, probably younger than 10.
Famous Antarctic geologist.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what was really significant was that I came to know of Antarctica as a place that you could go for work and a place that you could come back from. Because apart from that, I had read the sort of heroic age stories of Scott and Shackleton's expeditions, and, you know, things didn't end too well for them.
That's right. Shackleton did die in the end.
Yeah. So this idea of Antarctica as a place that you could go to for work and come back from and then go to again and come back from kind of changed my perspective on what Antarctica meant.
Mm.
Yeah.
I like the idea that in New Zealand your mother can date somebody who you will later be taught at university and has, it's a nice kind of thready thing that goes on in this country, isn't it?
Yeah.
The threat of climate change, of course, threads through the book. And the sea ice has been expanding in Antarctica, but the glacier ice is thinning, and so there's a lot of ice loss. And this weighs you down. I mean, climate change weighs you down. Why do you remain hopeful that we might be able to pull ourselves out of it?
Because we can. Because we can make that choice.
Well, yeah. You and I have both read Jonathan Franzen's latest article.
Yeah, that made me really cross.
He says, in order to limit warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees by 2100, as per the Paris Agreement, we'll need to approach zero net emissions globally by 2050. Is mm-hmm. that true?
Yes, that's true.
And he's saying, no way, Jose. What do you say?
Well, so what do you do? Do we just give right. up at that point? It is really tough. That is really hard.
He doesn't say... He says the false hope of salvation can be harmful because it means that we are weighed down by anxiety, futile anxiety, and nothing's going to change. It's going to feel like failures. We need to concentrate on living with it rather than fighting against it.
But it's not an all or nothing situation. It's not black and white. It's not we meet our Paris Agreement targets or we just give up and accept the apocalypse. Okay, there are lots of in-between scenarios here. So the Paris targets are that we, you know, no more than 2 degrees warming by 2100. And we're at 1 degree already. So we do have to be carbon zero by 2050. But if we don't quite make that, maybe we overshoot. Maybe we get to 3 degrees. That's a whole lot better than 6 degrees. It's a whole lot better than 8 degrees. There are a lot of in-betweens here. And so there are things that we do need to adapt to.
I mean, he Franson says, look, even if we can no longer hope to be saved from 2 degrees of warming, and I'm quoting him here, there's still a strong practical and ethical case for reducing carbon emissions. In the long run, he says, it probably makes no difference how badly we overshoot 2 degrees. Once the point of no return is passed, the world will become self-transforming.
Yeah, but... The point of no return is kind of a theoretical thing here.
You mean because we don't know where it is?
No, we don't know where it is.
Because, yeah, all right. Halfway cutting our emissions, he says, would make the immediate effects of warming somewhat less severe, and it would somewhat postpone the point of no return. I mean, he's pretty depressing, isn't he?
He is pretty depressing. Remember, he's not a climate scientist. He's a dude with some reckons on this, and I think we have to really listen to the climate scientists on this. You know, he put this out there in the New Yorker, and it made a lot of people in the science community really angry. He just sort of dropped it like a bomb. And he's got this platform there, this incredibly huge platform worldwide. And, you know, think of what he could have done with that platform. He could have done something a lot more positive and useful.
So, I mean, clearly you think there is absolutely no merit in his statement that to prepare for the climate apocalypse. I mean, he's not a climate change denier. But he's fully embraced it. He says the climate apocalypse is coming, and to prepare for it, we need to admit we cannot prevent it.
What is the climate apocalypse? At what point does that happen? Is that 3 degrees? Is that 6 degrees? Is that 8 degrees?
Do you know?
No, I don't know. But I do know that I'm willing to fight for it to be 3 degrees rather than 6 degrees. We'll aim for 2 degrees. It might be really tough getting there and we might not get there, but it's not a black and white thing. It's not an all or nothing situation. It's not 2 degrees or bust. Mm. There's a range of different futures that we can choose.
One of the kind of insights into what future we might see is played out by what you describe as the Sirius debate.
Oh, yeah.
Sirius debate in Antarctica. And it goes like this, doesn't it? That 3 million years ago in the Pliocene, when carbon dioxide levels were much higher and temperatures were warmer, and the sea level's 25 metres higher, was the East Antarctic ice sheet lost? Was it completely lost? What's the answer?
No.
It was still there.
Back when this debate was going on, there was sort of this argument between some people who said it was pretty much fully intact and some people who said it was pretty much a lot of it was lost. And the answer is, of course, somewhere in between. Yeah, it sounds like, I think the latest science is, and remember I'm not a scientist here, is that it was kind of soggy around the edges. So there was melting at the margins of the East Antarctic ice sheet, but it still was pretty much there.
You were emotional in Antarctica a lot of the time.
I think I cried just about every day the first time I was there, yeah.
A lot of things made you cry.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It just felt like...
Too much cigarettes, it started.
Something about I cried when I arrived. This kind of place that had been in my imagination for so long, it was suddenly I was there, and that was incredibly emotional time. But something just, I don't know, all the barriers came down. I think it's Antarctica is a place where it's easy to be honest and open. There's kind of all the superficial stuff of our world is gone.
It's a leveller.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just a cryy person.
Maybe you're just a crybaby, that's right.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is about Antarctica that you know, you wrap yourself up in all those layers of clothing. But in some way that anonymity might be quite liberating.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. We're kind of all the same. We're just all humans down there trying to survive. Yeah.
However, for somebody who does suffer from anxiety about flying, apart from anything else, it would seem to be a relatively masochistic exercise to go down there not once, not twice, but three times.
The thing is, I always forget that I'm anxious about flying. You know, so this,
like childbirth.
Exactly. So the kind of the excitement about it coexists with the anxiety, and in fact, the you know, excitement and anxiety are very sort of close together. And so I get excited and, you know, make these plans, and it's just, you know, right up in the lead up, like the week or so before, that the anxiety starts to ramp up. And, you know, I think part of it's about leaving my kids and being so far away from my kids. That feels uncomfortable.
And unable to get back to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Unable to get back. So it's only, you know, 5-hour flight or an 8-hour flight, but in a way it's a lot further away than North America or Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me what form your anxiety takes. I'm interested in anxiety. There's a lot of it around.
And physical sort of form, I just get very wired and amped, like, you know, like had too much coffee and my brain gets fuzzy, heart palpitations, breathing badly.
Panic attacks?
Well, I've only had a couple of full-blown panic attacks, but it's like the level just underneath that, a sort of big slow-burning panic attack. So I get this sort of jolting awake at night. Just a massive kind of physical overstimulation sort of thing. Yeah. And stops me being able to think straight.
Again, Sigur Rós would be quite handy, actually, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Quite a sort of calming influence.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you talk in your book about, there was one very challenging episode where you're alone. I think it was on your second visit, where you were alone in a small tent in the dry valley.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, it started snowing in the dry valley. So we were at about 1,300 metres.
That seems wrong. But the snow doesn't settle there, does it?
Well, it settled, and I didn't know this. It settles, but it blows away quite quickly. So I wasn't expecting it to snow, and I love snow, and it was absolutely beautiful. And I was in my little tent with snowing on the tent, snow all around me. And I think I just realised, you know, from going away into the tent by myself after being with all the guys in the Polar Haven tent having dinner, I just realised that I really didn't feel great. And I guess it's, as well as the anxiety, it's kind of dissociation sort of thing. I didn't feel, I just wasn't feeling right. I wasn't feeling real. And I was breathing badly.
I mean, it's like another planet, isn't it?
Yeah,
so suddenly you are on another planet.
Yeah. And that feeling of, I don't know if it's, it felt kind of claustrophobic. I couldn't escape. I couldn't get out. There was nowhere to go. You know, I felt like I was going to have a panic attack, but there was nowhere to go to. Yeah. I couldn't go and ask for help. I couldn't go into a different environment.
You didn't feel you could.
Yeah, but what,
No, yeah. I mean, that's not surprising, but nevertheless. And you were even too anxious to take your diazepam because you thought you didn't know what it was going to do under those circumstances.
Yeah, I just wondered if this is me overthinking things. I wondered if the altitude or something would impact on the medication, because it does with some medications. I worked myself into quite a state until I had to kind of just start laughing at myself and just giving into the situation. There's nothing I can do. you know, if I have a full freak out, no helicopters can come and get me because we're in a blizzard here.
But it turns out that you weren't eating enough.
Yeah, no, that was really interesting. Yeah. I just had a slightly queasy feeling tummy when I went up there. And you know, the toilet facilities were a bucket behind some rocks kind of thing. So not the kind of place where you want to upset tum. And so I thought, yeah, I'll just sort of stick to crackers and soup. And I won't eat too much, which of course is complete nonsense because in that kind of temperature, and it was down to minus 20 degrees, you need to eat a lot. You need to eat a lot, like twice as much as usual to stay warm. And I knew that. I'd been told that. But yeah. It was Cliff Atkins, who's a geologist I was with, who kind of picked it because I was just through the day, I was not feeling great. I was slow and just feeling cold and miserable.
Well, somebody wants to know whether you're going to write a reasoned response to Franzen. If you're not, I bet you know who is.
Other people have. There are some good responses to Franzen. There's one called Shut Up Franzen by Kate Marvel that you can find online. Another one, Home is Always Worth It by Mary Hegler. My colleague Kate Hannah pointed those out to me, and they're, yeah, definitely worth a read.
I was looking at Marianne Ayes Hegler's response, Home is Always Worth It, before she has, she calls him a nihilist.
Yeah, and a doomer dude.
And a doomer dude. And she says, right now, everything we do matters.
It does.
Which is not a relaxing situation to be in. And you don't find it so.
No.
I mean, you find this a stressful kind of position for us to be in. And I suppose Antarctica just brought it home to you, right?
Yeah, it meant that I was spending a lot of time with climate scientists in Antarctica and then back in New Zealand. Tim Nash and Richard Levy are people that I sort of worked with back in New Zealand, as well as spending time with them on the ice, going to conferences, looking at working on a sea rise project with them as well. So it was kind of always there in my head. But there's stuff that we can do. You can take that stress and anxiety and turn it into action. And that's beginning to happen now. It's like some giant ship we're on trying to slowly turn it.
Somebody says, I don't know what the point of this question is. Why didn't the powers that were notice that 100 years or even 50 years ago the climate was changing and the Earth was being degraded? Well, I mean, 50 years ago, I suggest to you that they do it. But for the same reason that not enough is changing now, that are status quo.
Sure, I was at university in the 1980s and we're talking about it then.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, if you didn't hear it, then I'm sorry. But these things always take time. And as you say, it's like turning around the huge tanker.
The science message comes first and then there's the sort of political will to make the change. But for that, you know, for that political mandate, we need the people to say, yes, we're on board. We need to do this.
Somebody else says the tundra was melting 20 years ago. Mankind is 30 years past the tipping point. The day of the Lord is at hand. That's arguable, isn't it? The day of the Lord as well as the tipping point, I suggest. Right. Claustrophobia.
Yeah.
Is easy to feel in Antarctica because not only the difficulty getting off it, but also, you know, the size of the tent.
Yeah.
There are always people around. You spend quite a lot of time making a deliberate effort, because you have to make a deliberate effort, oddly enough, to be alone.
Yes.
Does that help?
Yes. Absolutely, yeah. Probably the times when I felt best was when I was just going for a walk on my own and being in Antarctica, or with Alice Miller, who I was with on my first trip.
She's a poet.
And I think, you know, that really helped on my first trip because she was even more of an outsider than I was. And so we could kind of freak out together.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, share experiences. My second and third trips, I was with a, you know, bunch of sort of Antarctic scientists, people who'd been there a lot and were sort of very comfortable in that environment.
Do you think that there is something, and I don't mean to harp on about this, but it's a recurring theme in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there is something that caused your anxiety in the first place?
Yeah, I had anxiety as a child as well.
Do you know why?
Probably a mixture of genetic predisposition.
Yeah.
And, you know, my parents split when I was three, and that was that's apparently a vulnerable time for that sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Are you on top of it now?
Yeah, it comes and goes, and I'm kind of cool at the moment. I think if I'm, you know, I need to eat well, exercise, and not spend all my time working. Just to have a more balanced life, I can stay on top of it. If things are too crazy at work and I'm sort of not doing the other things, then it sort of amps up again.
You talk, and maybe it's in the last visit to Antarctica, you talk about how you've been working really, really hard for 2 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is, you know, family events and your intention.
Mm.
And it never occurred to you to prioritise yourself or your family and take time off.
No, I know. I don't know why I'm like that.
Well, because you're a conscientious individual and you think you have to work 24/7. Isn't it as simple as that?
Yeah.
To be worthwhile?
Perhaps. I came to academia late. I was in my 40s when I got my first academic position, and I was in my 40s when I got my PhD. So to some extent, I was trying to prove myself, but I probably overdid it. I'm doing okay.
I think you're doing okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But even in Antarctica, where you were there as an expert, you probably knew Antarctica as well as anybody else, apart from, you know, somebody been going there for 50 years. You still felt you got the whole imposter syndrome going on.
Yeah,
you
felt like
you didn't belong.
I'm not a scientist.
Yes, but you are, really.
Well, I'm science trained, but I've never worked as a scientist. My PhD's in the history of science rather than science itself. And I guess there's all these people down there doing this important science, and I was there.
But you know as well as I do that unless it's communication.
That's true, yeah.
Then, you know, trees in the forest and who knows if it falls, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know on one level that you're a worthwhile contribution to the world.
Sure, but, you know, most of this book I was writing in 2017 when I was doing the MA, and Trump had got in and there was extreme weather events around the world. And I did get to wondering, has anything that I've written ever made the slightest bit difference? You know, I'm writing a science column in The Listener. The people who read that are reading a page with science written at the top. You know, they're on
preaching
board.
Preaching to the converted.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
And so I do wonder with this book, I hope maybe I'll reach some different audiences who are, you know, it's not a book that says climate change on the front, that, you know, it's personal. It's about anxiety. It's about Antarctica. I don't know.
That would have been a snappy title.
What's that?
Anxiety and Antarctica. I was talking to climate scientist James Renwick yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was giving an address to the students who were there as a consequence of the Eureka Awards.
Mm.
And he was talking about, you know, the need for action.
Yes.
And I said to him afterwards, have you ever changed anybody's mind about climate change? You know, changed somebody from a denier to a action needed. And he had to think for a moment and he said, yep, there was one person. And it turned out to be the father of a colleague.
Okay.
Who had heard him speak. Now that's, you know, whether you're a half full or a half empty glass person, that's either good news or a tragedy. What do you think?
Usually we don't know. You know, the kind of communication that I do, I don't know how people are receiving it or if they're changing their minds. But one of the things that I was doing on my second and third trip to Antarctica was filming some lectures for an online course that we offer at Victoria University of Wellington, and a MOOC, an open course on the edX platform that's available to anyone around the world. And so Cliff's lectures were on geology and paleoclimate, and mine were on history. And we surveyed the students. We had sort of 7,000 students from around the world, a lot of them in the United States, and we surveyed them before the course and after the course. And some people did change their mind about climate change after watching Cliff's lectures. And they were in the United States. And that was interesting.
All right.
That about sort of engaging people in a quite a deep level and an immersive sort of experience, not overtly about climate change, it was about Antarctica, but just seeing all the evidence quietly presented to them, they sort of got it and changed their mind.
Does anxiety make you worry more about climate change, or does climate change in itself make you anxious?
It's a positive feedback loop.
Well, it's like anxiety is about, always quote this, anxiety is a bird that will always find a branch to perch on.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Yep.
So, you know,
I think anxiety about climate change is rational.
Yes.
And we should be anxious about it. And that anxiety, if we can then turn that into action.
Well, that's the trick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Otherwise, we just, you know, go to bed and pull the duvet up.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I had a chat with Tim Nash, who's, you know, all through the book yesterday. And we talked about how within our circle, our academic colleagues and friends and family, things are changing. The norms are changing. Conferences I go to now, generally all the food is vegetarian. At home, we eat a mostly vegetarian diet now. I use the bus. My husband has a bicycle now. These are a whole lot of little things. But if enough of us are doing these things, and if we have strong political leadership and business leadership and individual and community action, we can make these changes. It's our choice.
This is what Graham says in a text. He says, it's heartening that most of the public now accepts the science, but which of us are prepared to make sacrifices for our kids' sake, like not flying, less wasteful consumption, less ruminant meat eating? When people are willing to make those sacrifices, we might get somewhere.
Well, why would people... Who's going to stand up and say, I will not make those sacrifices because these things are more important to me than my kids and the future of our planet? I mean, seriously, if you come down to it, it's a no-brainer. And I think we need to talk about this more and talk about what we're doing and, you know, join hands a bit more and change the social norms around these things. Just look at cigarette smoking. That's changed. That, you know, it used to be widespread and socially acceptable to be smoking everywhere, and now it's not.
Whether things can change necessarily fast enough is the question.
I think that's where we need political leadership as well as individual and community action.
Right.
I mean, with plastic bags, I mean, how many of us are suffering now because we had to give up on single-use plastic bags? I don't think anyone is. Maybe the manufacturers.
All right. Well, we're all going to join hands and we're going to sing Kumbaya. But actually, before that, we're going to play another of the music that's mentioned in your book, 15 Million Years in Antarctica. And it's Bon Iver, Holocene.
Oh, great.
So very nice to talk to you. And thank you for the book.
Thank you.
Magnificent.
Bon Iver, Holocene. And I was talking to Dr. Rebecca Priestley, and that was one of the music that she listened to when she was in Antarctica, and that is what her new book is about. It's called 15 Million Years in Antarctica.